Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2017. Lecture 4, delivered on February 1, 2017. The title of this lecture is Introduction to Financial Statements.
Today, financial statement analysis. Now, I'm going to probably, I will spill this lecture chapter into next Monday, so I will delay the, or I will extend the deadline for Chapter 2 homework quiz and test by 4 days, by 5 days, just so you have a little more time to get to it.
Testing 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Today, financial statement analysis. Now, I'm going to begin with showing you some information resources that you've probably seen before, maybe forgotten about them, tell you how important they are, not just in this class, but in a lot of classes you'll have after this. And then I'm going to show you how to look at your first screens, stock screens. And I'll talk extensively about how to look at them, what to look for, how to think about what you're seeing. Now, in Business 100, if you took Business 100 here, you are introduced to different online resources. One of them that is emphasized by some instructors, not emphasized by others, is the Edgar filing system, the Edgar system of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Every public company has to report publicly to the Securities and Exchange Commission. It's a requirement. It's the law. When they become public, they make a series of disclosures pursuant to the Securities Act of 1933. Once they are public, they are in an eternal, perpetual program of recurring reports that they have to make to the SEC. When I was a consultant many years back, that was one of the ways I made my money. I was one of the people who was, I'd been exposed to computers before most people knew they actually were out, not science fiction. And I had one of the first laptops that was around the Toshiba T1000. I had a desktop, so I was able to do word processing and write these documents that would otherwise these companies would have to have paid a fortune for companies, attorneys, or accountants to do for them with typewriters. And I that was one of the ways I made money. Companies that are public, and we'll get to do a lot more of this as time goes on, but every company that's public must make a series of disclosures on Form 10-Q every quarter. This is like a little book. It has narratives discussing different things, and it has financial statements, and it has other tables of numbers, too. Every year, the company files Form 10-K, which is the annual version of the 10-Q. We call these the K's and Q's. Well, have you checked out the K's and Q's of this company? All that kind of stuff. Now, in my time, I would write these documents, and the K was just a friggin' nightmare. I mean, these things are the size of books. One company's one annual was a book. And then there were other documents like the annual report, the AR. I mean, it was just awful. And you had to consolidate, coordinate with the accounting people. You had to coordinate with management people for different parts of it. You had to check and go to outside places for some of the information. But these were information products. These are to this day the primary information products produced by accountants and finance people and then utilized by information consumer constituencies. I mean, inside of the company, there are consumer constituencies. Outside, you have the government's a consumer, unions, external special interest groups, fund managers, investment groups. They're all information consumers, and these are what they look at. These are primary from the company documents. They are filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission, so you know that either they are very truthful or they are complete lies. And if they're complete lies, you've either got a bunch of pathological people running the company or the government has given them permission to lie, which was what happened with the 10 largest banks in the country. They were filing K's and Q's that made the banks look like they were about to collapse. I was one of the investment analysts who was saying, you've got to sell these bank stocks. You've got to actually go short on the economy because these banks are going to collapse. As it turned out, these banks had massive amounts of money being shoveled in the back doors of them, trillions of dollars. The banks were not disclosing this on their K's and Q's because the Treasury and the SEC were in on this secret program. And so I looked like an ass. And a lot of investment managers had their lives destroyed because they were making recommendations that these banks were on the verge within hours of collapsing, and they were not because the SEC was turning a blind eye to what the Fed was doing.
But anyway.
So for the most part, though, these are trustworthy documents, primary, originating documents. Financial statements, analysis by internal people of the company, all kinds of great things. The Edgar filing system that we use now was pioneered actually in the, I want to say the late 80s. I was one of the original Edgar filing agents. It was a computerized way of doing these massive documents. You would use these tags that were the grandfather, well, they were the predecessor of the HTML tags that web pages used for many years after that. They would say, all right, here comes the title of the document. Okay, here's the close of the title of the document. Here comes the address of the company being, it was just all an electronic thing, and then you would file it electronically with the SEC through the old way we did things, which was called FTP, File Transfer Protocol. Much later, well, later would come another way of presenting information online called Hypertext Transfer Protocol, HTTP, which everyone uses now, but still FTP is back in the background. Anyway, I was one of the originals who was doing this, and once I got the hang of it, it made life a lot easier, and I made decent money doing this for companies, because otherwise they would have to have paid very, very expensive people to do it. There are other documents that are part of what the SEC requires. I mean, one that I made a lot of money on over the years was, okay, understand that these are recurring. Over and over again, you file the same document with new information. But then there are documents that you file for non-recurring events. For example, the one that I made a lot of money on was a Form 8K. This is a report of a non-recurring special event. In other words, if you are the CEO of a company and you die, we have to file an 8K because that's something that information consumers would want to know. You are the chief financial officer and an alien mothership has just caught you in a tractor beam, taken you in, and flown off to the Andromeda Galaxy. That is a non-recurring event. Don't see that every day. Anyway, so we would file an 8K on that. What I would do, one of the ways I would make money was I did these little companies, and some of them were very honest. They had very cool technologies and stuff like that they were trying to field. Then you had these scammers. And one of their favorite things was what was called pump and dump. What they would do is if a window was opening when they could, the insiders could sell their stock, what they do is they would issue bullshit press releases, pump the stock. And then, of course, the insiders, once the stock price went up, they dump as much stock as they could. They were allowed to under Rule 144. That's the rule that governs how insiders can sell stock. And every time they put out a press release, I had to file an 8K. So they knew that I wasn't going to. Sometimes I'd say, yes, we'll do a press release. I had my own press resources that I could push them out. But a lot of times they knew that what they were doing, I would say no to. So they went through these disreputable press services, and they'd issue them, and then they'd tell me afterwards. And I'd say, okay, we have to file an 8K, and that's going to cost you $75. For me, it was 2 minutes. Once that electronic system was in place, it was just like I had the electronic template. I'd fill in the information. It's just a couple of lines. This press release was filed or something like that, and I'd file it, and then I'd get $75 for it. So it was a way to make money. There are other forms that also, if, for example, you are a company that is acquiring a position in another company's stock, after you've reached a certain threshold percentage of ownership of that company, you have to file a form through the Edgar system for that. All of this is available in the Edgar electronic system. That is great. Now, by the way, interestingly enough, I made a decent living doing this, and then, of course, the SEC and Congress listened to the crying of the attorneys and the accountants, and now it's illegal for anyone but attorneys and accountants to do this kind of work. So there you go. But anyway, let me I'm going to take you on a journey here. Seriously? Now, the SEC filing system, this is useful to you, folks. Ah, there we go. This is useful to you because you're going to have classes, maybe more than a few, where they're going to have you research a company. You're also going to be going out there and getting jobs. You walk into an interview and you know diddly about a company, well, you're probably not going to get the job. But if you know, well, I went on the interwebs and I did this research and that research, yeah, most of your fellow job applicants are going to do that. It's like I see on people put on their resume, well, I know Word and Excel. Well, I'll bet you also know how to take a crap, too. Now, don't do that. If you're going to do something, go long, go hard. Go to Edgar and do the research on the company through the company's own words that every other news service uses for its information, that we, the investment analysts, use. Go with what the company has put to the SEC. Because here's the deal. If the company lies to the SEC and the SEC doesn't, if you don't, aren't given permission to lie like those banks were. You're just lying because you are a lying mofo. The SEC will catch you sooner or later, and they will make you some hard-timer's old lady at a federal facility. Okay? Yes. So don't do that. If you don't want to be Mrs. Bubba, don't do that. I'm blunt with you because this is the reality of it. And look, as a consultant, I had these companies want me to lie all the time for them, on their behalf. You tell them, you put this in that 10K. No, I'm not going to do that. Well, I'm just not going to pay. Okay, I'll tell you what. I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to call my people at the SEC, and I'm going to tell them where they can find your soon-to-be-incarcerated ass. Because, you see, the problem is that in the world where there's money involved, money at stake, people, there are some people, not a lot, but there are some people who really go toxic and they get vicious in ways that you can't imagine. And so I'm hard when I talk like this, but trust me, it's better to be able to sleep at night. Okay, but let me see. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to use Firefox. I'll quit it. Here we go. What you do is, I usually just do www.sec.gov. That's how I go in. Now, Go Filings, Company Filing Search. It's better if you know the trading symbol. Better if you know the trading symbol, because if you write the company name, you might get more than one company with the same name. I mean, one of my favorites, watch what happens if I just type in Sears. Hello, those are all companies that report. Now, most of those are connected, but only one of them is the one that I want to look at. But you see that? Look at that. So you probably, it's better to go to one of those places where you get a trading symbol. I'm going to do Netflix, NFLX. NFLX, Netflix. Bingo, got the company right on the first try. Now, well, spank me. They got a 10K up. Sweet. Now, one of the problems you can have is if the company has, if the annual report has been done, the fiscal year ended like 6 months ago, 8 months ago, that's going to be way out of date. But know this, when this is filed, immediately you are going to have thousands and tens of thousands of people and computers combing that document, extracting any information possibly useful. So this is not, unless you are going to go pro as an investor and investment analyst, this is information for research papers, for long-term studies of the company and all that. Because you're already going to have been beaten by the pros analyzing the document. Now let me show you. First of all, the one that we really care about is this one in blue. This is just awesome. This was not there back when I was an Edgar filing agent. Edgar is now all companies are required to file by Edgar. They have been for some years now. Back in my time, it was voluntary, I think. Oh, yeah, it was. Okay. If you go to documents, see this first one? That's the 10K itself. Now, when I click on this, remember, we used to make these on paper. That was how it was done since the 1930s. Here is the animal. Now, look at how monstrous this thing is. Now it's all electronically filed. But I will tell you this. This is an original resource. So if someone is wanting, what's the legal name of this corporation? Yeah, that's probably going to be it right there. That's the SEC. What's its address? Well, it's going to be there. How could I get a hold of this company? Right there. This thing is just loaded with information. Now there's a part here that is a favorite. It's called, we call it informally the MD&A, the Management Discussion and Analysis of Financial Condition and Results of Operations, the MD&A. This is written by the company's people. It is glib as heck. In other words, the word glib means they're being honest with you. They're telling you the story. And it just amazes me that over the years, this has been an honorable thing, telling what's going on, just sharing information about plans, what happened, what was good, what was bad, some of the changes in ratios, and we'll do ratio analysis next week, or changes in numbers and why they happened. It's a great resource for an overview of a company by the company's people themselves, and they're not going to lie. However, I need to make sure you understand that this is not amateur territory. We write in cryptics. We use terms to mean things. Back in the 1990s, I participated in a war that happened. The SEC opened up a battlefield. There was this movement in law and government called the Plain English Movement or the Plain Language Movement. It was this idea that we should make documents readable by anyone. Use plain language. Don't use legalese, financialese, economicsese. Use plain language. And the SEC invited debate on whether they were going to pass plain language rules. Now, some people might be surprised because I was on the side against this. And as I said it straight up to the SEC, I don't want Ma and Pa Kettle thinking that they can read this and understand jack about it. I don't want idiots who have barely a high school education thinking that they know as much as the people I teach. That's you. They don't. They're ignorant compared to you. You are different. You are special. You might want to say, well, I'm just a homeboy. No, you're not. You're different. And we use language in our profession that we don't want the average person to understand. I lost. They cast us as a bunch of elitists. Last thing I am is an elitist until it comes to this. But anyway, what we do now, we're supposed to use plain language. Well, we code what we say. You read these and from use your best intelligence, your college people, you're being college educated, and always ask yourself, what are they saying behind what they're saying? It's like this priest that I knew a long time ago, he said, for every prayer, there's a prayer spoken and a prayer meant. And you think about that, whenever we have to use plain language, we probably have our ways of saying things that the average person wouldn't understand. So read this cautiously and think your way through it. That's empowering you by trusting that you will get it. Okay, now, but my gosh, look at all this stuff that's in this in these reports. This is original source information from the company, and it's written for a number of different information consumers. Now, this is something I need you to understand, is that information is product. Producers of information are manufacturers of product. You make a product for a consumer group, a consumer constituency. So when we produce financial accountants produce information products for information constituencies. Financial analysts do the same thing. We are making products. We and the accountants create information products for consumer constituencies. Mostly, accountants have a larger number of information constituencies than a financial person would. A finance person, I am aiming at information constituencies like investors, like company people who want to know what the numbers mean, like researchers who want to understand what companies do and what their numbers mean. So my information constituency is narrower than the accountants. But together we put these things together for a lot of different information users. Now I'm going to take you back here. We're going to get back off this. Now you see this blue button, the interactive data? This is absolutely awesome because what you can do, we're going to go over here. And this is all their financial information, online, but look here. Every public company is required to put it into downloadable Excel spreadsheets. So you can take that, save it. I'm just going to open it here. And you can make charts. You can break it down for graphics. Document, here's the consolidated statement of operations. That's a fancy way of saying the income statements. Consolidated statements of comprehensive income. That's what's below in the numbers below the income statement. consolidated statement. Oh, that one. I mean, they've got things that I wouldn't even use for this. This is a statement of changes and retained, sources and uses statement, otherwise known as a statement of cash flows. Now, you guys in your accounting classes, did they use statement of cash flows or did they say sources and uses? Yeah, sources and uses is old school. It's what we used to say, sources and uses. So if you're hanging out with the old powerhouses of a corporation, I'm teaching you how to say things that'll make them think that you're one of their kind. But yeah, it's called cash flow, statements of cash flows. It's also, we used to call it the sources, where the money comes from, and the uses, where the money goes. This is probably the most useful on its own financial statement for financial people. Because what it does is it backs out all of the crap that wasn't cash flow. And remember what I told you, finance is all about free cash flow. Cash flow is king. I don't give a rat's ass about profit. What I care about is cash flow. You understand? So this is probably the most useful from a financial person's. Now, here's the balance sheets. Now, interestingly enough, back in my time, we gave 5 years of income statements and 3 years of balance sheets. Anymore, it's a lot less. But still, there you are. You've got all this information right there at your fingertips from the source, from the company. And the company knowing that if it lies or makes a mistake, it at best will get a hard fine, and at worst, someone is going to be prosecuted. And with Sarbanes-Oxley, the officers and directors have to sign their personal names to these financial statements, meaning that they are on the line personally, both civilly and criminally, if something is said wrong. So you know that if you go to Edgar to get your financial statements, there won't be any lies and there won't be any technical glitches. And I'm going to tell you this right now, and I'll just as a warning. There are all these sources where you can get financial statements of companies. Every last one of them sends a spider to the Edgar to get their financial information. They all do it. There's no other place to do it. However, even at the biggest, most reputable of those secondary resources, the spiders make mistakes. Yahoo Finance keeps doing this. It blew me away. When I first saw it, I thought I was losing my mind. I clicked on Yahoo Finance financial statements. See their financial statements here on Yahoo. And I clicked on it. It looked okay, but I couldn't figure out the line for interest expense. It just seemed weird to me. It was just two dashes. In other words, they had no interest expense. I thought, I was sure this company had long-term debt. They were paying interest. So I went over to Edgar. Oh, yeah, they had a nice big fat number. Oh, the spider glitched on that. And it turns out, still to this day, you look at the financial statements of most companies on Yahoo, it'll have two dashes, like there's a zero for interest expense. Watch it. Don't even bother for us with a secondary resource. Just go to Edgar. You can download this spreadsheet right here. And then you do, like I said, you can make charts and graphics if you're good at that kind of stuff and make yourself look like a hero in your reports and all that. Okay. Now, I'm not going to do that today. I'm going to do this on the class next time. I want to give you a caution, though. Now, I hate to keep saying this, but back in the day, we all used the same names for the same thing. I'm pretty sure we were required to use the same word for the same line of information, and we all had almost identical financial statements in terms of the number of lines and all of that back then. Now, it's like almost it's much more freeform. Look here, Netflix uses the term revenue. However, you'll see companies that will say sales. And a few companies will say net revenue or net sales, because that's usually, this number is not gross sales or gross revenue, it's net sales. I had an interesting thing. I had a couple of years ago, there was a marketing professor who wanted his students to do research, so he asked them these numbers questions about a company. And he said, what are gross sales? And the students, I had a bunch of his students coming to my office, they said, well, didn't you say that they were reporting net sales on financial statements, the ones that he told us to go to? And I said, yeah. And they showed me he was asking for gross. I said, well, you've got to actually go and back into those to find that. That's not easy to do these days. And so I talked with him a little later, and I explained to him that gross sales is not what you see on the financial statements. But some companies do say net sales, some say gross sales, some say revenue, net revenue, gross revenue, whatever. Okay, another thing. These days in modern financial statements, there is a line missing that is actually very important to us. It's a number, it's something called gross income. It is this number minus this number. And almost no company puts that intermediate line in there, even though from a financial analyst's perspective, and even from my perspective as a business person, this little intermediate result is hugely important. This is how much money survives my wholesale costs. That's exactly what that number is. So, in other words, and also, you got to change that ringtone. Seriously, I mean, that thing sucked. I mean, that's what my friend Lonnie used to say he heard after he'd taken peyote. I'm trying to embarrass you, son. Anyway. But, I mean, they don't put that in there now, so you have to get that one. And you're going to hear me actually want you to do that one because it's an important one. Now, here's another one, operating income. The other term for this, the one that is, sometimes you'll see it in financial statements instead of operating income, the one that we actually use much more commonly in finance is earnings before interest and taxes, EBIT, EBIT. Now, I'm pretty sure in your accounting class they said operating income, right? I don't know if they even told you that we call that EBIT in finance. And some companies in their financial reports to SEC, they call it EBIT, EBIT. So I don't know. Now I'm going to give you, so know that the same line, having the same meaning, can be written different ways now. It didn't used to be that way. We all had to use the same terms, but now there's more of a freewheeling atmosphere about this. One last thing to tell you about. When I ask the most important, what are the main financial statements? Okay, that's obviously the income statement. Some people call it the P&L, the profit and loss. That's a much more... Small businesses usually would say P&L or profit and loss statement. But the income statement, the balance sheet, and probably the statement of cash flows. Now, other ones like the statement of retained earnings are there too. But almost no one, if I ask what are the most important financial statements, almost no one would name the notes to the financial statement. The notes. The notes are actually one of the most important financial statements for analysts. Let me, because there is where they explain why the numbers are what they are. They explain their way of making the numbers. You see, the generally accepted accounting principles, you have to apply them consistently. But what vexed me as a business person for a long time, and it still does to this day, is that you can do things a lot of different ways as long as you explain the way you did it in the notes to the financial statements. You can almost, and I, heaven forgive me for saying this, but you can almost lie about the when you put the numbers in, as long as you explain how you lied in the notes. I learned this some years back. I helped companies go public and be public. But one of the important parts of that is to get a company that has gone public a trading symbol. And you understand that the SEC doesn't deal with trading symbols. That's all done by the market in which the stock wants to the company wants the stock to trade. The NASD is a small company's trading platform. Trading symbols have four letters. Then you have the AMEX, the American Stock Exchange, and the New York Stock Exchange. In order to get a trading symbol, you put your financial numbers and your story of your company through their compliance meat grinder. That's not the SEC's. Usually, these are tougher than the SEC. You could file, honestly, with the SEC, you could file gibberish. They might not notice it for years if no one ever said anything. The self-policing trading stock markets are a whole different matter. They take you apart limb by limb. I got trading symbols with the NASD, little companies. Only twice did I go through the AMEX. And but anyway, the NASD, okay. I was assigned, when I first started trying to get companies trading symbols, to a compliance officer named Claire. She was an old, mean, hateful, sociopathic bitch. And I loved her to death. Once she had made me know who her daddy was, she started teaching me how to do things. And one of the things that she made sure I knew, she said, as long as you put in the notes what you did, it's okay, because I'm not going to say anything to you. And investors who get pissed off at you because you screwed them, if you can point to the notes of the financial statement and say, I told you here what I was doing, you are going to get by with it. Now, she still expected me to be totally honest with her. But I mean, over the years, she taught me how to use the notes of the financial statement to shape my financial numbers. So when you go into an accounting class, or when any class says, look at the numbers, you know more than most people, because you know that the real story is in those notes to the financial statement. That's where you take the curtain back and you say, here's how I generated this giant load of bullshit in front of you. Now, you might think I sound harsh in this class. When I get student evaluated, he said a bad word. Okay, good. I'm trying to teach you how to live out there in a world of sharks, and I was one of them. And I'm okay with it. As long as I don't go to certain states or countries, I'm good. Now I'm going to take you on a journey back a little ways. I'm going to show you how to do a stock screen. I'm going to take you to finance.yahoo.com. I'm going to give you your first experience with reading a stock screen. We'll do this over and over in this course. I'm going to keep saying the same things over and over to you. God, I hate those twitching ads. God, that just annoys me. I want to just take a gun to the... Sorry. No, I don't want to see your stupid stuff. Oh, here we go. Okay, yeah, I click that and I get another one. Okay. What? Is there some reason why I... Yeah, I spend all night. I can't just sit there and look at me. You're arguing with the computer again, aren't you? Yes, I am. Netflix. $140.78 a share. Right off the bat, you know that. Now, if you think, well, I'm going to buy a share of Netflix, you know, that's stupid for a couple of reasons. The first stupid is that you are usually going to buy in a round lot. A round lot is 100 shares. So you better be ready with $14,078 plus broker's commission to be able to buy this. If you buy an odd lot, you're going to pay more per share, okay? You buy in round lots. Be cautious, because if you say, I want 20 Netflix, you make sure that if you want 20 shares, you say 20 shares, because otherwise you might have a surprise bill come to your door for 20 round lots. I'm being a little bit extensive about that, but at the same time, I want you to understand that we don't buy a single share. And the other reason you don't buy a single share of stock is because that stock, Netflix, is quite safe. That's a low, that's a defensive stock to a certain extent. However, on its own, that thing is a beast of risk, because any stock naked, it carries with it a massive amount of risk that you could get rid of if you just put it in a portfolio, in a well-diversified portfolio. And no market is going to reward you for being an idiot. If you buy a single stock on its own, you deserve everything that's going to happen to you that's bad. And you're going to have these people who say, I recommend that you buy this stock right here. Buy it on its own. I don't care. You don't need one of them portfolios, them fancy fund managers talk about, and them professors. I bought a single stock, and I made me a fortune. Sure enough, there's going to be someone out there who does that. But for every person who has that kind of luck, there are going to be 10,000, hell, 100,000 people who got their asses kicked being stupid like that. And you're never going to hear from them. Hi, I want to tell you how I got my ass kicked so you can do it too. No, you're not going to hear from them. You're going to hear from the winners. Just like lottery tickets. Just like anything that you play. Economic theory is powerful. We know that what's called utility theory works. The model is valid. For all consumer and business behaviors except for gambling. And stock markets are gambling. Utility theory isn't the one that we use for stock markets or other kinds of gambling. It's another theory called prospect theory. Prospect theory posits that losers will keep losing. They will dig in and keep playing. The more they lose, the more they'll play until they hit what's called gambler's ruin. They will continuously look at the winners to convince themselves to keep playing. You will pay attention in a lottery to the winner last week. You will not pay attention to the millions of people who lost last week. You will hear all about, and your mind will focus. We are rational animals. We have to believe that. But there is this glitch in us that keeps us digging in on risk. There are some cultural anthropologists who are saying there's actually a survival benefit to this stupidity. Because if we have 100 people take a risk and 99 are killed, the one who won probably won something that was beneficial to the next generation. Explorers, For every explorer we read about who had an incredible adventure, there were thousands who died horribly. But because those ones who won were revered and the ones who lost were forgotten, we achieved new worlds, new things, and new technologies. So prospect theory has a logic behind it for the idiots. Don't be one of those idiots, though. Don't buy single stocks because you're asking to get your rear end kicked. Doyen, now I'm going to have you look at things here. The previous close, that's how much it was when the bell rang to end the session yesterday, that's what the price was. It opened higher. Do you see that? It opened higher this morning. Excuse me. Now, bid and ask, important. This is the ask is what you're going to pay to buy that stock. The bid is what you're going to get if you sell the stock. There's a spread between the bid and the ask. I, as a market maker, made my money on the spread. I bought it for less than I sold it for. So you might get all pissed at me because you see, well, I'm looking here at 140.78. But you're telling me you're going to pay only 140.61 for it? Well, I'll go somewhere else. I'll say, be my guest. Please, you do that. Because anyone, unless someone is into the biggest charity operation on earth, we make our money on the spread between the bid and the ask. You got that? Don't be surprised if you're going to buy it at a higher price and you're going to sell it at a lower price. Notice, interestingly, the day's range. Did Netflix, in its range for the day, did it close closer to the low for the day or the high for the day? Low. So in other words, there was, at the end, there was selling pressure. That might tell us something about what could happen tomorrow, but you don't know. Okay, the 52-week range is from 79.95 to 143.46. So for the last year, is Netflix near its top or its bottom? Up. Is that a good sign or a bad sign? Bad. I'm going to be cautious here because I want to see if this thing breaks its neckline. I'm saying I've got a neckline there at 143. Netflix looks like the market was trying to push at that neck. Do you see how the market was trying to push at that neckline up there today? But it failed. That tells me that something is keeping investors from having the guts to punch through 143. And when I see that, you decide that you want to be a biker. You're not quite a biker yet. You bought some ZZ Top music, na 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 na. You bought some leather. But you're still a kind of a person who assesses situations as an intelligent person would. Okay? So you go up to a biker bar, and you see a bunch of bikers standing around. They walk toward the door, but then they kind of back away. Now, are you the kind of guy who's going to say, get out of my way, I'm going to go in there? Or are you going to take the advice of these guys named Skip, Ace, and Charlie, and not push your way through those doors? Probably, if you're an intelligent person, you're going to take what they're doing as a good sign that what's on the other side of those doors is something really, really, really bad. That's right. In that bar, they're playing Nickelback. And in an hour, it's dubstep hour.
I like Nickelback. So. Okay, look.
Volume. Notice that the volume today was lower than the volume that's been averaging for a while. Now, this is OB volume, OBV, on balance volume. Know that off the books, off the balance sheet, There's trading going on. So if you want to get pro, you start looking at full volume instead of on balance volume. Okay? I'm sharing with you knowledge that would... Market cap. This is the price per share times the number of shares outstanding. The price per share is the market's assessment of the value of a share. So that market cap is the market's assessment of the total equity value of this company. The market's assessment. Now, if you go on the financial statements and look, and I can't believe, I sure did. I'll knock it off with that. Let me get Netflix back up here real quick. Come on. Okay. Let me get over here. Balance sheet, come on. Seriously? Okay. There is the book value of equity. 2.2. Wait, which way is which? Okay. The last time that this was measured by the accountants, the book value of the company was 2.7. What are these numbers in? So that would be 2.7 billion. Now, the market, really? The market says it's 60 billion. So who's to believe? And here's the secret, the market. The market is where you will buy and sell. The market is where you will raise capital as a company. The market is where you will make your money or lose your money as an investor. You don't do that with on those financial statements, in the accounting financial statements. I can't emphasize that enough. Accounting has its place, but it is the market that is the final arbiter. It is the market... I used to say this, and I really don't like saying this because it's sacrilegious. But for our purposes, you can go to the temple of, I apologize, this is somewhat sacrilegious. You go to the temple of accounting for the invocations, but if you are looking to talk to the god of money, it's there. That's where you make your money and you lose your money. You don't make your money and lose your money in the accounting statements. That's where it happens. So when this market says Netflix is worth $60 billion, that is where it matters. Beta, one last thing. Beta is our measure of the non-diversifiable risk of this stock relative to the market portfolio. This is the measure of this stock's non-diversifiable risk relative to the market portfolio. The market portfolio is a theoretical portfolio that would include every company in the world in the portfolio to its proportion in the world economy. The important thing is to understand that this means that we are looking at a number, Netflix's risk in a well-diversified portfolio. If you buy Netflix on its own, if you buy Netflix naked, you will bear an incredible amount of risk. And most of that risk is ignorant risk that you should not be rewarded for, and the market is not going to give you a dime for taking. This number, 60.67, that means that Netflix in a well-diversified portfolio has 67% of the risk of the market itself. That's how you would think of it. In a well, so in other words, think about 1.00 as the fulcrum. The market portfolio itself would have 100% of its own risk. Anything above one would be riskier than the market. Anything below one would be less risky. So you can consider the lower the number below one, the more defensive the stock is. And you build your portfolio based upon what you think your defense position should be. Back in the 80s and the 90s, I would ask students, what's your beta? And they'd say, oh, I'm about 1.2, 1.3. Definitely. That's, yeah, because when you're young, you can take more risk because you have more time to make it up. Interestingly, over the past 5 years, I ask people like you, and they're more likely to say 0.8, 0.7. Young people have become much more defensive on their portfolios just because they have, I think in your case, we've talked about this, I've talked with other finance professionals. My theory is you have seen a much riskier world. Even though they say you're coddled and all that crap, you've seen things that other generations, after NAM, I mean, the generations didn't see a lot of risky things. You've seen more risks. At least you've been told there are more risks in the world than there used to be. So there you are. That's kind of what I'm seeing now. But for your own purposes, ask yourself, in financial planning, those of you who are going into financial planning, you need to know what the risk level is appropriate to your investing clients. But in order to know that, you should also know what your own risk level is. Are you a beta greater than one? Are you a beta less than one? What's your beta? Are you a treasury bill? Treasury bills have a beta of zero. They're completely riskless in a well-diversified way. Are you a maniac? Do you invest in high-risk, high-speculation projects? Would you be a beta of 2, 2.5? That's insane. You're getting a real serious risk there. What's your beta? That will guide you when you start doing investments. Because if you just buy what someone tells you to buy, we find people with portfolios that they are staggered when we explain to them what risk level. Well, I just bought what people told me to. Well, are you saying it's not well diversified? Well, yeah, actually, it's a pretty well diversified portfolio, but this is a portfolio of someone who generally uses meth. I mean, your risk level is insane. So once you know this, it helps you shape what kinds of portfolio, and almost every stock you look at, you can find what the beta is and shape a portfolio where the weighted average of the betas is somewhere around what you want your risk level to be.